Chad and Molly left the party without any farewells. When Fraser joined Niles, she took his hand, and he gave her one of the most radiant smiles I have ever seen. It struck me speechless that I was instrumental in the coming together of this teenaged couple, who instantly seemed to be completions of each other. Betty Roberts and Ike seemed to be getting along well, too. What had Starla called me? For the first time in my life, I could call myself a matchmaker. I now felt I possessed an innate power I had never realized existed. Looking around the yard, I saw that it was a good party. I was surprised to see Molly, having remembered her manners, return to the party through the garden, flustered and red-faced. I arrived to back up Niles and Fraser, but recognized immediately that neither of them needed reinforcement. Molly still carried the markings and insignias of the Charleston society girl, an inoculation against the anarchy that had managed to break through her impregnable lines of defense. She was a southern girl born to please rather than to think, to charm rather than to issue calls to arms. I loved girls like Molly Huggy, and always had. But she had returned to fight a battle her boyfriend had just lost. Instantly, you could tell that Molly loathed conflict in all its contentious forms. Also, I saw a flanking movement take place on my right, and noticed that my mother's wolf-like attention to mayhem was guiding her to the scene of discord in her yard. I hurried over to cut her off. Although I could explain many things to Molly about what the gloss of unfamiliarity my southern home represented, I lacked the time or energy to explain that she had entered the spectral garden of James Joyce. I intercepted my mother before she could enter the fray. "Let me take care of this, Mother. What did that Rutledge boy say to you out there by the oak?" she asked. "We were just getting to know each other." "You're lying. He was attacking you." "I fought back, Mother. I held my ground." "Now you're not lying, so go stop the fight that's about to break out between Miss Fraser and Miss Molly." There was a sibilance that meant a mocking irony when she used the word Miss. When I reached the group at the fringes of the party, I heard Molly saying to Fraser, "If you won't let me talk to you alone, then I'll say it in front of everyone. Chad's not leaving until you're in the car with us, Fraser. I wouldn't embarrass you in front of strangers for anything. You know that about me." "I'm having fun, Molly," Fraser said. "I'm having a good time, maybe the best of my life. Why does that make you and Chad so unhappy?" "Because it's not right. It's not who we are or what we were raised to be. We shouldn't have come here tonight. Leo was wrong to ask us. He knew very well what he was doing." Her tone irritated me. "Just what was I doing, Molly?" "This party," she said, "is like a can of mixed nuts. It's all wrong. Everything about it. You know what Chad's father is going to say when he finds out Fraser was set up with a boy from the orphanage." Someone came up beside me, and I turned to see Sheba. "If you don't like it, then leave the goddamn party, and don't you dare say one thing to my friend Leo King. He may be the nicest boy I've ever met." But Niles intervened. "Go with Molly, Fraser. She's right. I'd only spell trouble for you. Starla and I don't have much to offer anyone. Heck, we had to borrow these clothes to come to this party. Guess we better get back to the orphanage." "You got a 12 o'clock curfew," I told him. "My mother called Sister Pollywog and arranged it."
"So you can kiss my ass, Molly," Starla said with all the sultry darkness and mystery of the Blue Ridge in her low-pitched voice. Trevor Poe came up from behind. "Molly, you are such a vision of loveliness and spirit. Come into the house and I'll play love songs to you until my fingers fall off. Now, Sheba, Starla, you girls go easy on Miss Molly."
"Trevor, don't you see?" Molly said, pleading now. "We weren't raised like this. There's nothing here for people like us, nothing of value. Our values I'm talking about."
"What about compromise?" I suggested. I'll drive Fraser home before midnight. The orphans have to go back to St. Jude's in the bus with Mr. Lafayette. My family and I can leave right now, too, Ike said. You are my guests, Ike, I said. I hope me and my family have made you feel welcome tonight. I'm talking about Molly and Chad, he said. They don't seem happy that we're here pretending that we're something else besides niggers.
I didn't say that, Molly said, and now her body language suggested she had come up against an entire army of invasion she was not born to understand. And I don't think that. I promise that hasn't entered my mind. It's hard to explain to outsiders. We were raised with great privilege, but also with great expectations. Family is everything, the one holy word, the glue that holds our whole society together.
So the orphanage and the Negro marching band got to you tonight? Starla asked, her dark eyes glittering dangerously. She turned to Betty and Ike and told them,
Got to thank you two. Me and Niles have never got to feel like high cotton until tonight. I think Molly actually rates us higher than she does you.
Shit. This girl's making me feel like high society.
Put a lid on it, Starla, Niles snapped. Chad's the idiot here, not Molly. He's put her in a bad situation. To Fraser, he said, Go on, Fraser. A lot of stuff happened tonight. A lot can still happen.
I'd consider it a personal favor, Fraser, Molly said. I'd love you to death if you'd do it. Just this once. I'll never ask it again.
Fraser considered it a moment, then surprised us all by saying,
Is it okay with you, Starla? I'd rather be with you and your brother than with my brother. Ike and Betty, I've been made to feel like a freak by this phony Charleston society since I was born. But tonight, I felt good. And I like it. Y'all made me feel good.
Betty hugged Fraser and said,
It was great to meet you.
And Ike added, I got a feeling we'll be seeing each other again. Then Fraser turned to me and kissed me lightly on the cheek.
You throw the best party of anyone in Charleston, Leo King. And I've been to all of them.
When Fraser and Molly had said their goodbyes to my parents and to the other adults they knew at the party, I walked them to the front, where Chad sat in his car. He was not fuming and distracted, as I expected him to be, but coolly confident to the point of boredom. After they left, the party moved inside. Most of the older folks also made their farewells, but many stayed on, surprising me. And that's when Sheba and Trevor Poe took over. They made the memory of that evening belong to them, their spectacular debut in a very oddball demimonde of Charleston non-society. Trevor started out by getting all the adults slow dancing as he played the favorite songs of my parents' generation, songs that suggested the unknowable fears of the men and women separated by oceans during World War II. It was the first time we found that Sheba sang like a fallen angel remembering paradise, her voice rich and golden-toned and throaty. Because music is an inexplicable awakener of the dark engines of our immortal souls, I remember every song that we danced to during that magical night. When Sheba noticed that most of the party could not dance well, she turned the living room, the den, and part of the kitchen into an elaborate dance studio. Then she arrayed us in long, undulating lines as we learned to shag and twist and do the fish and the mashed potato. At center stage, Sheba and Trevor Poe found themselves exactly where they belonged. If Salome had danced half as sensuously as Sheba, I understood the severance of John the Baptist's head. Sheba frequently ordered us to change partners. I would spin around and find myself dancing with Starla in her dark eyeglasses, then my shrink, Jacqueline Criddle, then once with my mother, then once, hilariously, with Ike, and we performed the dirty shag to the sounds of Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel. It was a joyous, miraculous, unrepeatable night. After the orphan's bus disappeared behind the imposing iron gate of St. Jude's, my father asked me if I would take a short ride with him. He drove me to the Battery. We walked up the cement stairs, then moved to the point where the Ashley and the Cooper meet to form the beautiful immensity of Charleston Harbor. As always, you could feel the force and power of the collision of the two rivers. That fusion meant the extension of each river, yet neither seemed happy about it. My father took me to this exact spot when I was 18, Leo. His father had taken him here for the same ceremony. My grandfather's father had done the same thing. We don't know how far back the tradition goes. I'd planned to take Steve here when he was 18, but that didn't work out. When Steve died, I decided to let this tradition die with him. But I changed my mind tonight. Father took 2 silver cups and a pint of Jack Daniels from a pouch he was carrying. He poured a finger of bourbon for himself, then he poured a finger for me. My father wanted to share my first drink. He told me how much I meant to him as a son, and that he hoped he had proven to be a worthy father. At the joining of these 2 rivers, he welcomed me to manhood. He asked me to be a fine man, the best man I was capable of being. I promised him I would. I ask the same of you, Leo. I'll never be able to be as fine a man as you, I said as I raised my cup and touched his. But I'll give it a run for its money. That's a promise. No, I've put a study on you in the last couple of years, he said. The moon caught us in a sluice of its magical light. You're not just going to be a fine man, son. You've got potential. You might even become a hell of a man. If I do, it will be because I've worshipped you, I said. I want to grow up to be just like you. We drank, and the moment felt transformational. All I could do was hope that Father would prove right. So began the time that would alter my vision of things forever. Many years later, the past is calling out to me in a canny, undermining voice, but the starting point was always on Bloomsday, the summer before my senior year. By the time I had my party of celebration on July 4th, the cast of major characters had all made their entrances. The forces that brought us all together would take their good time in both tearing us to pieces and teaching us the subtleties and indiscretions and high watermarks that bring such pleasure to friendships. I thought I had discovered some friends who could not love one another more, and I was almost right. The following May, we left our graduation stage positive that we would live fascinating, self-actualizing, and amazing lives. We promised we would make a difference in the world we are about to storm. As a group, we did well. As friends, our love sustained us for a while. Then it began to lose some of its lustrous sparkle. But all of us came roaring back to one another in the middle of our lives by something as simple as a knock on the door. Part 2. Chapter 8. Knock on the Door. There is a knock on my door. I check my calendar. It is April 7, 1989. I have written down no appointments on my schedule today. Everyone in the newsroom knows I close my office door only when I am writing a column, and I consider those hours of creation sacrosanct. On my door, I have a printed sign hanging from a picture hook that says, "Leo King is hard at work on the column that has made him famous in Charleston, while the rest of his colleagues labor in well-deserved obscurity." In other words, I am busy writing literature that will never die as long as there are men and women who love the human spirit. Keep your sorry butts out of here until I've finished. Then I signed it with a flourish. That godlike man, Leo King. My colleagues have defaced the sign with the vilest graffiti over the years, making it increasingly difficult to read. The knock grows louder and more insistent, and I can hear a crowd gathering outside. I stop typing, make a note to myself about the train of ideas that is now derailed, and walk to the door. I fling it open, fully prepared to shoo away the intruder. A woman stands outside my door, and her presence in the newsroom could not have surprised me more. The woman's face is well known all over the world. Her exquisitely proportioned body has appeared on dozens of movie posters, half-clothed in both lingerie and animal skins, and in one infamous shot involving a rock python as she strutted her admirable stuff in her birthday suit. She has no appointment, nor is she in the habit of needing to make them. She is wearing a white dress that barely seems sufficient to contain the voluptuous curves of a body that now seems old-fashioned when most actresses are intent on looking underfed. She had obviously vamped her way across the newsroom, attracting 20 or so curious souls, mostly rutting males, but several star-struck females who are mesmerized by all things Hollywood. If you do not know that Sheba Poe is a movie star in 1989, you are admitting to a monastic life. There is a very good chance you don't subscribe to the News and Courier, which reports every Sheba-related event, no matter how outlandish or scandalous. Sheba is the only major movie star who has ever come out of Charleston, South Carolina. We cover our dream girl with the reverence we think she deserves. Charleston never did Mexican food very well, but when we exported Sheba to the West Coast, we sent them a fiery jalapeno stuffed enchilada. "Excuse me, ma'am," I say, "but I'm writing a column, and I'm working on a deadline." Behind her, the reporters boo me roundly. The crowd has begun to swell as the rumor of Sheba's appearance makes it through the building. I can think of nothing more combustible than Sheba and a crowd. "How do I look, Leo?" she asks, playing to the crowd. "Be honest." "Good enough to eat." I regret the words as soon as I speak. "Promises, promises," she says, and the crowd roars in appreciation. "Introduce me to some of your friends, Leo." I want to defuse the situation quickly, so I choose a few faces in the crowd. "That horny one is Ken Berger, down from the Washington Bureau. Beside him is Tommy Ford. Over there is Steve Mullins. That's Marcia Gerard, who's about to ask you to sign her bra. Over there's Charlie Williams, who wants you to sign part of his body, but the part's so small you'll just have to initial it." "I'll write a love letter on it, Charlie," Sheba says. The movie critic, Shannon Ringel, cries out, "I better get a damn interview, Leo. Don't hog her." "Are you the bitch who panned my last movie?" Sheba says, silencing the room. She possesses a voice that can meow or send a pride of lions out to hunt water buffalo. There is no "here, kitty, kitty" in her question. Shannon gamely says, "I think you've done far more distinguished work." "A critic," Sheba sneers. "I call pest control every time I meet one." "Sweet Sheba," I say. "Please excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Miss Poe has had a long day making lifelong enemies wherever she drifts, and I still have a column to write." "Leo and I were high school sweethearts," Sheba says. "We were not," I reply. He's hung like a rhino. "I am not." I quickly lead Sheba into my office and shut the door. Sheba has developed the planetary ego that keeps her star bright among the Milky Way of ambition that brings the prettiest girls and handsomest boys spilling into Hollywood every year, an endless river of hormones and wishfulness that is always for hire. But when I shut the door, Sheba sloughs off her diva role and transforms herself into the teenage girl who brought so much joy and mystery into my senior year of high school. She pinches me on the butt as I walk back to my desk, but does it in a playful, not a seductive manner.
"You're still uptight about sex, Leo," she says.
"Some things never change," I say. "I haven't heard from you in 6 months. None of us has."
"I was making a movie in Hong Kong with my new husband, the moody auteur."
"I haven't met your last two husbands."
"Believe me, you didn't miss anything. I just came from the Dominican Republic, where I got the quickest of quick divorces."
"So Troy Springer is history?"
"His real name is Moses Berkowitz, which is fine, but he had a mother who made Mrs. Portnoy look like June Cleaver or that Swedish broad from I Remember Mama. The bitch changed her name to Clementine Springer. I caught her sonny boy in bed with a 16-year-old actress who was playing my daughter in the movie."
"Sorry, Sheba."
"Men, say something in defense of your sex," she challenges me.
"We'd be fine, except they gave us dicks."
The crowd has not broken up completely outside of my doorway, and I can still hear the murmuring of disappointment among the reporters as they begin to drift back to their desks. As I listen to Sheba, who begins to talk easily to me, I study her at my leisure. It is easy to forget about Sheba's thoughtless cargo of pure sex appeal. Her voice, husky and familiar, sounds like one of the most seductive forms that lovemaking can take. She has taken possession of the entire building by the simple fact that she entered it. Only one person has noticed that her entrance was unauthorized. There is a peremptory knock on my door without a trace of caution behind it. Blossom Limestone, the gladiatorial gatekeeper who checks visitors in and out of the newspaper with all the efficiency of the marine drill instructor she once was, has muscled her way through the crowd and walked right into my office. She places a muscular black hand on Sheba's right shoulder, but looks at me when she scolds, "Your fancy friend did not go through proper channels, again."
"She hasn't been here in 3 years, Blossom," I say. "She can sign in at the front desk just like everyone else."
"I love the feel of your hand on my shoulder, Blossom, darling," says Sheba, taking the large hand and holding it against one of her own ample breasts. "I've always loved the gentle lesbian touch. They and they alone know how to make a woman feel right. They get right to the point. No gamesmanship, no role-playing."
Blossom snatches her hand away as though it touched a burning coal.
"Lesbian?" she asks. "I got 3 sons, and used Baron as a dump truck last time I checked. Now sign this piece of paper and the time you got here."
Sheba signs with a flourish, her signature taking up 4 spaces on the log sheet, and there is boldness even in its illegibility. Then she says, "I came in where the delivery trucks load up. My brother and I used to help Leo on his paper route. I was a regular here long before you came, Blossom Angel."
"So I've heard," Blossom says.
"Sign in with me next time, Miss Poe, just like everyone else."
"I thought it was so cute the last time," Sheba says. "You sold my signature for $50, or was it 60?
Blossom looks shaken by the revelation, then recovers.
"I sell it, or someone steals it."
Again, a small crowd has gathered at the doorway, watching the fireworks between the 2 strong-willed women. Sheba has not noticed the audience until she turns around and sees their hushed, expectant faces. I prepare myself for the worst, and the worst comes as I am forming the thought.
"Let me sign your left tit, Blossom. No telling what you could get for that," Sheba says.
The reporters by the door exhale audibly. They would have laughed out loud except for their deep respect for Blossom, who fields the responses of the crazies who charge her reception desk at the first appearance of an article that offends their paranoid sensibilities. I can see that the remark has cut Blossom deeply.
"She didn't mean that, Blossom. Sheba can't help playing to the crowd. She's a nice girl."
"She might be a lot of things, Leo. A nice girl is not one of them," Blossom snorts. She's come back to you because she's after something. You watch yourself. I clap my hands and order, "All of you, get out of here. I've got a column to write for Sunday and a deadline to get it in." When we are alone again, Sheba looks up with the only expression of hers that can pass for shyness. Then both of us laugh and hug like a brother and sister. "I'm sorry I act like that, Leo. I'll get over it. I do it to everybody, I promise."
"You're not the only one," she whispers in my ear.
"I know, Sheba. You can be anything you want around me. I know who you are. Don't forget that. Why are you in town?"
"Besides the fact that I'm washed up, used up like a snot rag, my agent hasn't had a call for a starring role in over a year. I'm 38. For a woman in Hollywood, that's like being 1,000.
"That may all be true," I say, "but that's not why you're here."
"I came back to see my old friends," she says. "I need to get back to what I once was, Leo. Surely you can understand that."
"But none of us has seen you more than 10 times since we graduated."
"But I call. You've got to admit I'm good about checking in by phone."
I cover my eyes with my hands. "You phone drunk, Sheba. You phone stoned. Do you know you asked me to marry you the last time you called?"
"What did you say?"
"That I'd divorce Starla and gladly marry you."
"You and Starla aren't really married, and you never have been."
"I've got the papers to prove it," I say. Sheba says with a cruel, blade-like quality,
"It was a sham love affair, a worse-than-sham marriage, and it's caused you to live a sham life."
"You can't fool me. You came back just to inflate my ego," I say. "Before you arrived, Sheba, I was feeling kind of successful here in Charleston.
None of my Hollywood friends has ever heard of you."
"Are they the same ones who quit calling your agent?"
"The same ones." "You've been nominated for 2 Academy Awards for Best Actress," I say. "You won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress."
"That's a great career."
"But I didn't win Best Actress."
"A nomination means zip for your career. It's like choosing to sleep with the gopher or the best boy on location instead of shacking up with a leading man." "You've done okay with leading men," I say. She smiles. "Married 4 of them. Slept with all of them." "Can I quote you?" I ask, moving toward my typewriter.
"Of course not."
"Okay, Sheba. I ask very little of you.
Just give me enough salacious gossip and unexpected rumor so that I can knock off a column for Sunday.
Then we can blow this joint and get drunk with our friends."
"Ha!" she says. "You're using me, exploiting my world fame."
"It hurts me you'd even imply such a thing."
My fingers hang over the keys of my typewriter. "No one knows about my divorce from Troy Springer.
That's breaking news," she says. "Was he your 4th or 5th husband?" I ask while typing.
"Why are you so fixated with numbers?"
"Accuracy. You'll often find that among reporters. Why are you getting divorced from Troy? People magazine called him one of the handsomest men in Hollywood."
"I bought a vibrator that has more personality and does its job better."
"Give me something I can use in a family newspaper," I say.
Our careers had been growing apart, especially after I found him banging the kid in the hot tub.
"You took that as a bad sign?"
"Yeah, I was trying to get pregnant at the time," she says.
"Can you remember all of your ex-husband's names?"
"I can't even remember what half of them looked like."
"The worst person you ever met in Hollywood."
"Carl Sedgwick, my 1st husband, she says without hesitation.
"The best person?"
"Carl Sedgwick again.
That's how illusory and contradictory that city is." "What keeps you there?"
"The belief that I'll one day be given the best role ever handed to an American actress."
"What keeps you from going mad while you wait?"
"Big peckers, strong drink, a ready access to pharmaceuticals."
"You can get the liquor here in Charleston."
"A martini tastes a lot better when you hear the Pacific crashing into the cliffs below you."
"Can I just say you're dating a pharmacist?" I ask.
"You most certainly cannot." "What do you miss most about Charleston?" "I miss my childhood friends, Leo. I miss the girl I was who first drove into this city."
"Why?"
"Because I had not laid waste to my own life then.
I think I was a nice girl then. Didn't you think so, Leo?
I look up at her and still see the lost girl she is talking about.
I never saw a girl like you, Sheba, before or since.
As I watch her, the journalist inside me wages war against the young boy who was Sheba's first friend in this city. The journalist is a cold man, bloodless in the pursuit of his profession, paid to be a voyeur and not a participant in the passion plays I enter with my notebook open. Detachment is my theme. As I watch her open up her wounds, I do not mourn for the girl she misplaced on the day we met, but instead for the disappearance of that offbeat, miserable boy who took a batch of Benny wafers across the street to welcome a pair of long-suffering twins to the neighborhood. In turning myself into a reporter, I extinguished all the fires that boy displayed as proof of his worth and humanity. Though I can be objective about Sheba's life, I have long ago lost any ability in taking stock of my own. She continues to talk with a nakedness of spirit I have never seen in Sheba.
And what did I do with that girl, the one you liked so much, the friend you came to love? She asks.
You answered the bell, I say as I type. You had a calling and a vocation, and you never questioned it or looked back. No one could stop you or stand in your way. The rest of us followed our destinies the way most of mankind does. You grabbed hold of your own dreams of yourself. You rode it out of town, took it to the limit. Few people do that. Sheba lifts her hand above her, closes her eyes, and makes a motion as though she is erasing an invisible blackboard.
You make it sound noble, but you know that girl well, Leo. She considered acting to be a writ of the highest order, and there were times she was right. That girl became the toast of Hollywood. But then the crow's feet appeared near the eyes, her skin began its coarsening, and she could not laugh during close-ups because of three distinct lines on her forehead. I've never had a husband who didn't suggest I have a facelift. So the girl gets scared in the middle of the journey, and gets so eager to please that she starts accepting every role they throw at her. Bimbos and nymphomaniacs, shoplifters and anorexic soccer moms who turn into serial killers.
I thought that was one of your best roles.
The script was dead on arrival, she says. But thanks, Leo. Remember London?
Never forget it.
I played Ophelia on the London stage. I was 24 years old, and all of England went crackers when they chose this unknown American broad to play this suicidal Danish girl. All of you Charleston friends came over for the opening. Trevor flew out from San Francisco with his new lover. What was that boy's name?
I think that was Joey, I say.
No, Joey never saw me in Hamlet, she says. I think that might have been Michael the First.
It was Michael the Second. I never met Michael the First.
Whatever. Trevor changed boys like flip-flops in those days, she remembers. Do you remember the party you guys gave me after the first night? What was that restaurant?
It was called L'Etoile. I still go there when I'm in London.
Remember when the reviews came in? The critics said there had never been an Ophelia like you before. Richard Burton and Laurence Olivier came backstage to congratulate you. It was one of the great nights of all our lives.
Sheba smiles, then darkens again. Last year, the same theater called from London. This time they wanted me to play Gertrude, Hamlet's bitch of a mother.
I'm not yet a hag, Leo. Give me another year or two. Though I've abused them quite seriously, this face and this body can still play a young, beautiful woman with devastating wit and effectiveness. There are 7 women more beautiful than I am in Hollywood today, but only 7. And I can bury most of those dwarves by the force of my personality and the power of my acting. Do I see the hag forming in this face?
I do. I see everything in this face, every flaw, every wrinkle, every imperfection that sneaks up on me as I sleep off a hangover or pretend to have an orgasm with a new Hollywood flavor of the month. I feel like I should approach every mirror with a gun in my hand.
Whoa, girl, I caution. We're sliding out of great acting into melodrama.
I don't need to act with you, Leo. That's one of the reasons I'm back here.
You'll be a beautiful old woman, I say, looking up at her again. She throws her head back, laughing.
I'll never be an old woman. That is a promise, and that, sir, you can print.
What's the real reason you're back? I ask. Is it to check on your mother?
That's one of the reasons. But there's one other.
She trails off, and then the phone rings.
Hello, I say. Oh, hey, Molly. Yeah, you heard right. She's sitting right here in my office. Everyone's going to meet at your house for drinks and dinner?
I place my hand over the phone and say, Word's out. You got plans for the night? Molly's called the gang and they're all rallying at her house.
Sheba says, Tell her I wouldn't miss it for the world.
She'd love to come, Molly. See you at 6. I'll tell her the guest house is ready.
A knock at the door interrupts us again. I can tell the sheer weight of Sheba's celebrity is about to overwhelm us. The moment of intimacy has come and passed out of both of our reaches.
I yell, Come on in!
The youngest journalists in the newsroom have summoned the courage to knock and ask me to introduce them to Sheba. Amelia Evans steps through the door first and says, after apologizing to Sheba,
Leo, I'm going to get fired if I don't get an interview with Miss Poe before she leaves the building.
Sheba, this is Amelia Evans, fresh out of Chapel Hill. Editor-in-chief of the Daily Tar Heel. Hottest young reporter we got. We're lucky to have her. This is Sheba Poe, Amelia.
Is it true you dated Leo in high school, Miss Poe?
Amelia asks, before she gets permission to conduct the interview. I can feel the tops of my ears burning as the blush catches my whole face off guard. I say, No, we never dated. We were just friends. A grin of mischief crosses Sheba's face, as she watches my squirming.
Leo and his modesty. He just made love to me on his mahogany desk, and then he pretends we never dated.
This newspaper is too cheap even to buy the publisher a toilet seat made out of mahogany. Amelia, take Sheba to meet her fans in the newsroom, then interview her in the library. I'll finish my column, then come get her. Behave yourself, Sheba.
Since he was a very young man, Leo always had the sexual appetite of one of the great apes, Sheba says.
Ellen Wackenhut, who came to work in the newsroom the same year I did and who is now the science editor, hears the remark as she passes. She sticks her head in and says,
The sexual appetite of a great ape? What else haven't you told me about yourself, Leo?
That I made lousy friends in high school, I answer.
Ellen says, What one word describes Leo in high school?
Sheba pauses, then says,
Edible?
Get Natalie, Ellen calls out through the newsroom. Where's the food editor when we've got a homegrown story?
Newsroom humor, I say to Sheba. One soon tires of it. Get Sheba out of here, Amelia.
These people are fine. I'd like to work up here, Sheba says.
They're journalists, Sheba.
These are poor, desperate souls, working for starvation wages that couldn't keep you in makeup for a month. Playing to Amelia and rising out of a chair, Sheba says to me,
I never wear makeup, dear. What you think is makeup is simply great acting.
After turning in my copy, I meet Sheba in the employee parking lot, open the passenger side door, lean in, and throw empty drink containers, fast food wrappers, half-empty popcorn boxes, and a catcher's mitt into the back seat. With a theatrical gesture, I motion for Sheba to enter. She gives it the once-over, then enters with that resigned look of a tourist who has just been offered a ride on the back of a mule. As I turn onto King Street, she asks, more out of politeness than curiosity,
What kind of car is this, anyway?
It's called a Buick LeSabre.
I've heard of them, she says.
Not a single soul I know owns one or would ever even think about buying one.
Don't you buy this kind of car for a servant, or when you start getting Social Security?
I'm a Buick kind of guy. My grandfather sold them for a living.
I never knew that. That might be the most boring fact I've ever heard.
I have a wealth of boring facts, I say. What do you drive in Hollywood, goddamn California?
I've got 6 cars, Sheba says. One's a Porsche, one's a Maserati, 4 are something else.
Sounds like you're not much into cars.
My new ex-husband's nuts for them. He talked to them when he polished them.
Was he a nice guy? Before he started screwing starlets?
She leans over and grabs my hand, a sweet and sisterly gesture. I don't marry nice guys, Leo. Surely you know that by now. And you haven't exactly dazzled in your choice of women.
Ouch, I say.
You seen your wife lately?
Sheba is watching me carefully. She came back last year, stayed for a couple of months, then lost it again. We had some good times while it lasted.
You need to Aretha Franklin that girl, Sheba says, then begins singing D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
They made me take vows, I say. I took them seriously.
I've taken those same vows lots of different times. They talk about richer or poorer, better or worse, that kind of crap.
Those vows don't say nothing about being padded cell crazy, do they? I knew there were problems when I married Starla, so I didn't walk into that marriage blind. I believed in the power of love then.
You were innocent, Leo. So were the rest of us, but not like you.
But I've turned into the most sophisticated and worldly of men. I'm looked upon as somewhat of a Renaissance man here in this city.
How is your mother, Sister Mary Gonzo, Count Dracula, Godzilla, Norberta? She asks.
I still let her into the morgue each night.
Want to swing by and see your mother?
I ask her.
I had lunch with my mother today, Sheba says. It's getting serious, Leo, just like you told me 6 months ago.
Let's drop the subject of mothers, I order. Our friends are gathering south abroad to celebrate your return to the holy city.
We drive beside Marion Square, with the old citadel anchoring the border, the statue of John C. Calhoun grimly surveying the harbor from the highest pedestal in town. Sheba insists that we roll down the windows so she can inhale all the complex aromas of the city, and I acquiesce, even though I consider the inventor of the air conditioner the equal of the caveman who invented the wheel. Beside me, Sheba snorts and breathes in the smells of the port city.
That's Confederate jasmine I smell. It's low tide in the rivers. That's the smell of the pluff mud.
All you're smelling is carbon monoxide, the fumes of rush hour traffic.
Sheba looks at me. What happened to the romantic in you?
He grew up.
We shoot past Hyman's Seafood and Slave Market, which is crowded with tourists in Bermuda shorts, T-shirts, and flip-flops. Then we are stopped at the traffic light at the intersection called the Four Corners of Law. Catty-cornered is St. Michael's Episcopal Church in its starlight whiteness and all the assuredness that good taste can bestow on a house of worship. I once got in trouble with the Roman Catholic Bishop of Charleston for begging him, in print, to hire only Anglican architects whenever he felt like erecting a new grotesquerie in the Charleston suburbs. My co-religionists who worship in those toadstools wrote me hate mail for weeks, but their vitriol did nothing to make their churches prettier. As I pull south abroad after the lights change, the siren and flashing blue lights of a police car catch me by surprise. Instinctively, I look at my speedometer and see that I'm traveling at less than 15 miles an hour. I go quickly through the list of items that allow me to drive as a free South Carolina citizen without a criminal record. Insurance, registration, tax receipt, license renewal. And I am certain I have taken care of these responsibilities in an efficient and timely manner. A rarity in my life.
You didn't moon that cop behind us, did you, Sheba? I ask.
If I mooned someone in South Carolina with my beautiful ass, there'd be lawsuits and fatalities. In L.A., only lechers and lesbians notice.
Sir, a cop says as he approaches my car. Put both hands on the steering wheel, then slowly get out of the car. Let me see your hands at all times.
Officer? I ask.
What seems to be the problem?
I'll ask the questions, the cop says.
I can hear the black inflection softening the ending of every word he speaks. Place your hands on the hood of the car and spread your legs wide. There's been a reported kidnapping of a well-known actress by a local sex offender. Son of a bitch, Sheba, I say. It's that living pain in the ass Ike Jefferson.
Ike!
Sheba screams. She leaps from her side of the car. They rush into each other's arms, and Ike spins Sheba in ever-widening circles, to the delight of the ladies who sell their tightly woven baskets of sweetgrass to tourists and locals alike. Ike has been a hero in Charleston's black community since he was a young man, and it is not a surprise to the basket ladies to see him whirling the most famous white girl in recent Charleston history. Because it always terrifies me in the most primitive fashion to be stopped by the police, no matter how innocent I am or how bogus the encounter, it takes me several moments to stop my hands from shaking. I take my hands off the hood, only to have the baton of another cop poke into one of my kidneys. A female cop, I realize as I hear her harsh whisper.
Freeze, white boy. I think you were given a lawful order to place your hands on the hood of your ugly white trash car.
Don't hit me with that stick again, Betty, I say, or we're going to have a fist fight in the middle of Meeting Street.
Resisting arrest, threatening a police officer, says Betty Roberts Jefferson, Ike's wife and a sergeant on the force.
You heard it, didn't you, Captain?
I did, Ike says. Search his trunk, Sergeant.
I hope you have a search warrant, I say. Of course, Betty puts one in front of my face, signed and sealed by Desiree Robinson, the first black judge in the history of the city courts. The worst year in American history was 1619, I say. Sheba is laughing at me, still enfolded in Ike's powerful arms.
First black slaves imported into the Virginia colony. It's been downhill for the South ever since.
When their cackling finally passes, Ike says,
Sheba, ride in my squad car with me. Betty, you ride with that cream puff white boy.
Not until I give this girl a hug, Betty says, turning toward Sheba.
Hey, Sheba, how's my favorite white bitch?
The two women embrace fiercely. Sheba says, Betty, let me take you west. I'd have casting directors screaming all over themselves to put you on the silver screen.
Got to stay here and keep my eye on the new police chief, she says,
nodding in the direction of her husband.
Chief! Sheba cries loudly. You're the goddamn chief of police in Charleston, South Carolina, Ike Jefferson? What happened to good old white racism? Segregated lunch counters, whites-only drinking fountains. Where is it now that we really need it? Chief of police! I've never felt this much pride for anyone in my whole life.
I say, it's amazing what a little graft, corruption, gun smuggling, and drug dealing can do for a bad cop's advancement.
It won't happen for a few months, Ike says to Sheba, ignoring me. Then there'll be a big ceremony and the Citadel's going to throw a parade in my honor. It'd be an honor to me for you to be there.
Wild horses and a role in the next Spielberg movie couldn't keep me away, she says. No, I'm lying about the Spielberg movie, but only Spielberg could keep me away. That's a promise. Who are you going to invite?
Dignitaries, big shots, Ike says, giggling. Just the cream of white society. Hell, even Leo won't be invited.
I'm buying dental floss that weekend, I say. I don't have time to eat chitlins with social-climbing black traffic cops.
Put that white boy in handcuffs, woman, Ike says.
He opens his patrol car for Sheba, bowing elaborately as she sweeps into the front seat.
I'm tired of his lip.
Betty and I drive behind Ike's car.
Think my man's safe with Sheba? She asks.
A man's never safe with Sheba, I answer. And there's never been a woman born who didn't know it.
She's always looked like a movie star, carried herself like one. It's almost unnatural, isn't it? Oh, I almost forgot. The future chief ordered me to handcuff you, Leo.
In an effortless motion, combining experience and deftness, she cuffs my right hand to the steering wheel.
Take the handcuffs off. I don't want to report you for police brutality.
I love Betty's high-pitched laugh.
It excites me to see you in handcuffs, Leo. Makes me feel like a dominatrix. You know, the old white-black thing reversed.
Race, I say. At least it's not complicated down south.
Yeah, Betty agrees. We always have that. Complete ease and trust among my people and yours.
We turn into the driveway of the mansion on East Bay Street where we are gathering for the evening, the home of Molly and Chad Rutledge. Sheba rushes out, runs up the front stairs, and she and Molly hug, screaming on the piazza. Ike, Betty, and I watch from our cars below. Leaning over to remove the handcuffs, Betty gives me a quick peck on the cheek. "Do you know what I love about Sheba coming to town?" she asks. "I always feel more alive. I feel that something big is about to happen."
"It's no accident she's here, Betty," I say. "Sheba will take us all to center stage tonight."
"She'll never be happy, will she, Leo? What does she want from us?"
"I'm sure she'll tell us. Nothing comes free with Sheba." "Our girl's in trouble," Ike says.
"Did she say anything to you in the car?" I ask.
"Her typical Hollywood bullshit," Ike replies. "But I think she's in trouble."
"That girl's been in trouble her whole life," Betty says, shaking her head. "Are we really going to Chad and Molly's? Every time I walk in their door, I feel like Cinderella going to the ball."
Ike laughs. "With your cop's uniform and those shit-kicker shoes?"
"Use your imagination," Betty says. "This is a ballroom gown, and I'm wearing glass slippers. Leo, give me your arm. I'd like a white southern gentleman with a sense of style to lead me into the Pinckney Barnwell mansion."
With a smile, I escort Betty Jefferson up the winding exterior staircase of one of the 25 most distinguished private dwellings south of Broad. Molly comes out to greet us on the veranda.
"Hey, Molly Mouse," I say.
"Good golly, Miss Molly," Ike adds, and we all take turns hugging Molly.
I catch a glimpse of Sheba roaming toward the guest house. Molly says, "Sheba insisted on a quick shower and costume change before the other guests arrive. Let's go to the library, where Leo will be in charge of making drinks. I picked up some T-bones from the Piggly Wiggly. Do you and Ike mind grilling them if my absentee husband does not make it home from his office?"
"Chad's working late again?" Betty asks.
"Am I wrong, or does he spend more time at his fancy office than he does at home?"
"You're not far from wrong."
"Hey, Leo," Molly says as she holds me close to her. "I need more than a proper greeting from you. Do you mind putting a hickey on my neck?"
All of us laugh. "I was thinking about a more creative place. How about your right thigh?"
We enter the great house and walk past 200 years of Charleston history in the shape of antiques too exquisite to sit on or otherwise use. In the center of the room, a chandelier hangs that looks like an ode to cut glass. An ebony grand piano stands guard in a corner overlooking the Copper River, and a great fern-shaped harp stands in elegant attendance across the room. In all the years I have known the Rutledge family, I have never heard anyone play either instrument. I have never sat down on one of the priceless divans or chairs made by the earliest furniture makers in the colony. In its lackluster inertness, the room strikes me with the same pity I feel for an abandoned child. The piano and harp seem like they are dying from the absence of melody. Charleston is filled with such somber rooms maligned by lack of use. The large dining room, with a mahogany table large enough for 24 shapely but fragile chairs, finds use only on special occasions, and it too exudes a feeling of sterility and desertion. I would bet a month's salary that it has been years since someone has eaten breakfast in its forbidding shadows. But in the library, the house springs to delicious modern life with its well-stocked shelves of books that climb from floor to ceiling along one wall, the huge TV where we gather to watch the Carolina-Clemson game that is a communal right in our state, the comfortable chairs and sofas, some leather and some made from the most decadent fabrics, the wet bar with its tiers of bottles, the fireplace with its renowned grill work by the great Charleston cabinet maker Thomas Elf. This is a room that carries happy memories for all of us, the place we come to party, relax, and sometimes fall apart. It was filled with the memories that attend the reef-like accretions that build up friendships. That is the necessary role Molly plays in all our lives. The first real grown-up our circle produced. A mother figure long before she even became a mother. Only her husband, Chad, seems incapable of appreciating his wife's goodness and wise counsel. But all of us are old enough to know that marriage is an institution that can breed hostility and indifference when none is justified. Molly puts me in charge of distributing drinks. I have played bartender for this group ever since high school, when I was the only one among us who didn't drink. I pour gin and tonics for Molly and Betty, and retrieve a Heineken from the small refrigerator bar for Ike. But he says, "Hey, you gossip columnist." I turn to him. "Excuse me, sir? I consider myself the conscience of this town. It's Daily Chronicler. It's heart and soul. Now, do you want me to get your sorry ass a beer or not? I drank beer when I was a traffic cop. What do you think the new chief of police should drink when he steps into high society?" "I got to put up with this shit for the rest of my life," Betty says. She lifts her glass to Molly, who touches it in a show of solidarity. "Would his lordship like wild turkey on the rocks? A margarita with a salt-rimmed glass? Or an old-fashioned, a Manhattan? Or would you join me in a dry beef-eater martini, stirred like a son of a bitch not shaken?" "I love that 007 talk," Ike says. "Yeah, give me that James Bond drink. It kind of reminds me of myself." All of us look up when a figure in the doorway materializes without warning. Molly says, "What's the password, Mountain Boy?" Niles Whitehead smiles and takes in all the faces. "Molly Rutledge is the goddamnedest broad in the history of Charleston." "Not true," Molly says. "Your own wife is." "Except for my own wife," Niles agrees. "What about my damn wife?" Ike says. "About time, husband," Betty says. "Niles, you quit that flirting with Molly." "I'm allowed to flirt with my sister-in-law, Betty," Niles says. "It's almost a requirement in Charleston. But I make it a habit not to flirt with a woman who packs iron on her hip, especially when her husband's in the same room and glad to provide backup." "Hold your fire, Ike. Don't shoot the mountain boy when he runs his mouth. I like it when the white boy flirts with me," Betty says. "Betty Jefferson is the goddamnedest broad in the city of Charleston," Niles says.
"I like the sound of it," Betty says.
"You can tell the mountain boy's being sincere. He's not full of crap the way you Charleston boys are." "Thanks, Niles. You made it sound real nice." "It's the orphan factor," I say. "Niles always gets a break from women because of his Oliver Twist background."
"Oliver Twist? I've heard of him. We go to school with him?" Ike asks.
"I married an idiot," Betty says, covering her face. "Don't forget, I grew up in an orphanage too, Ike." "You guys go down and light the charcoal," Molly says. "I don't know where we're going to eat because Sheba didn't hand out a production schedule for the evening's events. By the way, Leo, your mother's invited too." I stop dead as Niles and Ike laugh and head down to the yard. I groan, and there is not a person in the room who does not understand the authenticity of that sound.
"Why did you do that, Molly?"
"Cowardice comes easily to me. So does human weakness. True Southern girls need to please, no matter what the consequences. Monsignor Max called and said he heard Sheba was in town and wanted to come see her. He offered to be your mother's chaperone. He caught me by surprise, Leo. I'm truly sorry."
"Doesn't seem like a good idea, Molly," I tell her. "Sheba and my mother aren't members of each other's booster clubs."
Molly comes up and kisses me lightly on the cheek.
"I also knew you'd forgive me, no matter what I did. You always have, Leo."
"You've always been my weakness, kid."
"Weakness my ass," Betty says, grinning at both of us. "Look at Leo's eyes. He's been in love with you since high school, Molly. The boy never could hide it, still can't. Used to be cute, now it's just sick." I ignore her and ask Molly, "Did you tell Sheba that my mother's coming?"
"Yes, I did," Molly replies.
That's what I'm really worried about. The doorbell rings, and I know that my mother and Monsignor Max have arrived. I shudder at the multifold possibilities the evening holds in its precarious balance. Since my father's death all those years ago, my mother and I have skirmished over the most trifling matters, and have even gone to war on several occasions when confronted by issues that neither of us felt to be paramount. A new combustibility has grown up between us that can easily turn a pilot light into an inferno. Recently, my mother threw a drink in my face while we were arguing the place of colons in an English sentence. Mother thought of them as elegant pauses and an artful way to let a sentence breathe. I thought of them as ostentatious. When Father died, my mother and I lost our referee and middleman, our greatest fan who could translate the hidebound idiosyncrasies that could drive us crazy in a moment's notice. We forever lost that demilitarized zone that kept us from each other's throats. Yet she is constantly searching for inroads to navigate our relationship, and I know that this party is the ultimate white flag she can use from her breached walls. I appreciate the gesture of goodwill. I let my mother and the Monsignor in the front door. Though I should have known better, I do not notice the gargoyles forming on the waterspouts or the trolls licking their lips under the boxwoods.
I know I was the last person you were expecting to see tonight, my mother says as I peck her cheek.
Mother and I could give college-level courses in false displays of affection. I was delighted when Molly told me, I answer. Hello, Monsignor Max. It's wonderful to see you. If that little mink Sheba thinks she's going to come to Charleston without seeing me, she's got another thing coming, he says. You and Mother make a handsome couple, I say. Come on in. I'll make you some drinks. The guest of honor is planning a grand entrance.
The only kind she knows, Mother murmurs as she leads the way to the library.
As I pour drinks for the two of them, red wine for my mother, a dry vodka martini with two olives for the Monsignor, I say, this martini is Saharan or Gobi-like. It is the martini's job to bring me closer to God, the Monsignor says, then sips with satisfaction. It brings me halfway to God, then I must rely on the awesome power of prayer to take me to the summit. Then you must teach me how to pray in the proper manner, Monsignor. A man's voice comes from the doorway, and I look up to see Chad Rutledge putting his briefcase on a bench. The Anglicans teach that drinking is the fastest way to approach God. Charlestonians think it's the only way. What's wrong with our theology? Join us in a drink and we'll talk about it, Chad, the Monsignor says. Let me do the honor, I say. I'll even bring it to your chair. I like it when you're sycophantic, Leo, Chad says. It's so rare these days. I try not to make it a habit, Chad. You like it too much. I think it's the natural order of things. He winks at my mother. I pull down the sterling silver cup, part of a set that Chad received the night he stepped down from his position as the youngest president in the history of the South Carolina bar. I pile the cup with shaved ice, then half fill it with wild turkey.
Where are your children, Chad?
Mother asks. Banished to their grandparents' house, Chad answers. It still amazes me that my father, the guy who Fraser and I barely saw in our childhood, has gone bonkers over his grandkids. Monsignor Max says, I've seen it happen dozens of times. He probably realized he was a bad father, and this is his way of making it up to you and your sister. I wait for Mother's onslaught and don't have to wait very long.
Every night I pray for a grandchild.
Can't have everything, I say as I carry a tray full of appetizers around the room.
Look around you tonight, Leo, Mother says.
We can hear the rest of our group coming up the back stairs.
It doesn't seem that hard to attract a real wife, one who lives with you, shares your bed, and devotes her life to your happiness.
On the way over, the Monsignor confided that he could get you a papal annulment with no trouble whatsoever. It'd take 3 phone calls, Monsignor Max says. Now is not a good time to talk about it, I say.
Name a good time, son, and I'll be there, Mother says. A tribe of cannibals couldn't keep me away. Drop it, Mother. My brother-in-law approaches from the west. Molly enters first and comes up short when she sees her husband, relaxed and sitting in his leather chair. She goes over to kiss him.
Darling, so good of you to come. How on earth did you find your way to our house?
Someone at the office lent me a compass and a street map, he responds good-naturedly. Now behave yourself, darling. I think this could be a famous Charleston evening if we just let ourselves enjoy it.
A night to remember, Fraser Whitehead says, moving in behind Molly. Wasn't that the name of a movie?
Certainly was, sis. Chad's voice is as smooth and soft as a dropped silk handkerchief. It was about the Titanic.
My mother whispers to me, but loud enough for most people in the room to hear.
It's funny talking about your marriage, then the Titanic. A perfect segue, don't you think?
Mother, I don't think this event's about you. My voice is strident.
I disagree, Chad says. This evening is about anything we decide to make of it. Don't let your son inhibit you, Dr. King. I'll always be grateful for how you helped me and Molly during our senior year in high school.
You and Molly proved a gamble well worth taking, Mother responds.
I told her at the time, Monsignor Max says. If you can't trust a Rutledge or a Huggy in Charleston, then we might as well move to Myrtle Beach. Mother's always enjoyed helping millionaires out of tight situations, Chad, I say. It's a hobby of hers.
When did you notice that Leo was like this, Dr. King? Chad asks.
At a very early age, I'm afraid, she replies.
Again, a door opens and shuts in the rear of the house. Niles and Ike file into the den, Niles holding a bottle of frosted beer and Ike still working on his martini, bringing with them the smell of burning charcoal from the garden. They greet my mother and the Monsignor. Niles then walks over to the television, turns it on, inserts a videotape into the VCR, and directs everyone's attention to the screen. Ike says,
As you can imagine, Sheba is not just going to walk up here to have dinner. Since the day we met her, Sheba's been in the middle of a performance that had no beginning, and it certainly ain't going to end tonight.
When we see the movie flash onto the screen, all of us recognize the opening credits of Sheba's first big Hollywood break, The Roar of the Girl Next Door, starring Dustin Hoffman and Jane Fonda. As the credits roll, the camera establishes the setting as Manhattan, with a score by Thelonious Monk that sounds like sex being performed in three-quarter time. At the entrance to a posh women's boutique, the camera lingers. The door opens. A 19-year-old Sheba Poe, luscious, desirable, yet innocent and dewy in her own way, bursts out of that shop like an orchid opening up to sunlight. The same camera registers the almost heartless pleasure she takes in the effect of her own beauty on the men she passes on the street. She is wearing a low-cut white summer dress that clings to her body like a new layer of skin. The camera veers in front of her, capturing her dazzling walk down Madison Avenue, the ripeness of her figure strutting toward the lens like a force of nature as powerful as a tidal surge. There is a shot of her long, coltish legs and her sandaled feet and the dark red of her toenail polish, which had been enough to make me consider a minor league career in foot fetishism when I saw the movie for the first time. The eye of the camera turns to the people on Madison Avenue, watching her languorous passage, the wolf-whistling cab drivers, the lunchtime construction workers yelling from high beams, teenage boys blushing, fashionable dowagers torn between envy and admiration. She stops suddenly and checks her makeup in the reflection of a plate glass window that is decorated with shining tiers of diamond rings, brooches of ruby, amethyst necklaces, and watches that look like fancy collars for chihuahuas. A shot of her magnificent behind is captured from the point of view of a Middle Eastern cab driver. Cars honk in appreciation as she moves away from the window toward the traffic jam that she has created. She smiles and winks at the cab driver. He adjusts his rearview mirror
and she freshens up her lipstick as he counts his worry beads at a higher rate to match both his rapid heartbeat and the haunting music. She continues her walk down the runway that is Manhattan Isle. There have been very few walks in Hollywood history that have achieved such attention or acclaim. When the set designer's name appears on the credits, we hear someone entering the back door of the library, an entrance designed to not go unnoticed. We turn to see her in the flesh. The actress Sheba Poe, wearing the same dress and the same sandals and the same pearls, the same shade of lipstick and nail polish, and the same hairdo she wore in the movie we are watching. Synchronizing her moves to the action on the screen, Sheba walks through the center of us, and we applaud the pure imagination of this homecoming. A natural ham, Sheba plays to her hometown crowd by adding bumps and grinds as she struts to that throbbing soundtrack, which sounds like it was written for some band fertility rite. As our eyes flicker from the screen to the live woman, it is not just a good figure on a woman we praise, but a body that helped define feminine shapeliness for a generation. As the young Sheba crosses Madison through the traffic that is backed up to honor her beauty, the real woman weaves through the couches and chairs in that paneled library. In the film, horses rear up with cops trying to bring their mounts under control. A distinguished-looking man emerging from a florist watches her approach, then bows and hands her a dozen white roses. Sheba curtsies to the gentleman, puts one of the roses between her teeth, then begins passing out the others to a homeless man, a young mother pushing a stroller with twins, and two sewer workers who have popped out of a manhole to observe her passage. Molly cut white roses from her own garden that day, and Ike seizes the moment by stealing them from their oriental vase and handing them to Sheba with their stems dripping water on the rugs. Sheba puts one rose between her lips, then passes out the others to everyone in the room, saving the last for the Monsignor, who beams. As the assistant producers are named in a passing trilogy, a crane operator high above studies Sheba's walk through a pair of binoculars. We turn from the screen toward the real woman, who has now walked to the end of the room and is coming back toward us. I watch her approach, the lyricism of her promenade toward the friends who honored her before she made this walk famous on movie screens around the world. Not a single critic reviewed that movie without mentioning Sheba's concupiscent walk, in which she seemed to define sex itself as something brand new, some interior fire she had stolen and reincarnated in her own image. In that opening sequence, Sheba Poe walked into the cold heart of her complicated history by displaying an allure dangerous in both its carnality and its innocence. The opening score is slowing down, and Sheba's celebrated walk is ending. She vamps her way over to the screen as her younger self enters a high-end restaurant and spots Dustin Hoffman at a table, impatient and fidgety. Looking down at the younger incarnation of herself, Sheba waits as he stares at his Rolex over an empty wine glass and says, "You're late. Again." Sheba the younger is joined by Sheba the older in the library on East Bay Street, with her high school friends around her, as she speaks her first line of dialogue in a film. "No one else seemed to mind, darling," the two Shebas say in unison. "Except you." The room explodes into applause, and Sheba curtsies demurely. After her ovation, she poses in front of the Monsignor as though his delighted face were a mirror. For as long as I have known Max, he has been as comfortable with center stage as Sheba has, and he obviously loves that her last act is in his honor. It would have provided a perfect ending to her performance if Sheba had not repulsed my mother with the shamelessness of her performance. "Oh, stop it, Sheba," Mother says. "You've made enough of a display out of yourself for one evening." With wicked timing, Sheba says, "No one else seemed to mind, darling, except you."
My mother's disapproval seems to both delight and disturb her, but the jawlines on both women are wired tight.
You have a God-given talent, Mother says, yet you glory in playing the role of a tramp.
That was the part I was hired to play, Sheba responds. Would you like the scene better if they had dressed me in a garbage bag and combat boots?
I've read the stories about you in Hollywood, my mother continues. I know the choices you've made, and I know you were born with free will like the rest of us.
I try to think of a way to change the subject and the razor-like tension in the room.
Mother,
I begin, but my voice is weak. I'm trying to think of a nice way of saying shut up.
Your mother is a guest in my house, Leo, Chad says. Any of my guests has the right to free speech.
Isn't that sweet, I say.
Go fuck yourself, Chad.
Easy, Leo, Niles warns.
Why don't we get those steaks on the fire?
Ike adds. But neither Sheba nor my mother is finished with the other. Sheba starts by saying,
Mother Superior, may I borrow a tampon? I left all mine at the Betty Ford Clinic.
I'd like to wash your mouth out with soap, Mother spits out. How dare you say something like that in front of the Monsignor? The Monsignor pats my mother's hand.
Remember, dear, I've spent a good portion of my life in confessionals. It's hard to shock me.
Sheba's eyes do not leave my mother's.
It's acting, Mother Superior, just great acting. Lean back and enjoy the pure fraud of it.
Not fraud, my dear, Mother answers. I'd call it losing one's soul a little bit at a time.
I would never twitch my body to arouse the lust of every man who passed by.
Hail, Dr. King, Fraser says, trying to lighten up the room. I probably would have, but it wouldn't work for me.
It worked on me, kid, Niles says.
Fraser continues.
Sheba's a movie star, Dr. King. Being sexy's part of her job description.
It's part of every woman's job description, Betty says with a laugh.
Being sexy is one thing, Mother snaps. Being a slut is another.